"'Enford, do you mind waiting here a moment while I go and telephone?' asked Bernard. The savage waited and watched. The main day shift was just going off duty. Crowds of lower-caste workers were queued up in front of the monorail station. 700 or 800 Gamma, Delta and Epsilon men and women, with not more than a dozen faces and statures between them. To each of them, with his or her ticket, the booking clerk pushed over a little cardboard pillbox. The long caterpillar of men and women moved slowly forward.
"'What's in those?' remembering the Merchant of Venice. "'Those caskets?'
the savage inquired, when Bernard had rejoined him.
"'The Dizum Russian,'
Bernard answered rather indistinctly, for he was masticating a piece of Benito Hoover's chewing gum.
"'They get it after their work's over. 4 half-gram tablets, 6 on Saturdays.'
He took John's arm affectionately, and they walked back towards the helicopter. Lenina came singing into the changing room.
"'You seem very pleased with yourself,' said Fanny.
"'I am pleased,' she answered. "'Zip. Bernard rang up 30 minutes ago. "'Zip, zip.' She stepped out of her shorts. "'He has an unexpected engagement. "'Zip. Ask me if I take the savage to the feelers this evening. "'I must fly.' She hurried away towards the bathroom. "'She's a lucky girl,' Fanny said to herself as she watched Lenina go. There was no envy in the comment. Good-natured Fanny was merely stating a fact. Lenina was lucky. Lucky in having shared with Bernard a generous portion of the savage's immense celebrity. Lucky in reflecting from her insignificant person the moment's supremely fashionable glory. Had not the secretary of the Young Women's Fordian Association asked her to give her a lecture about her experiences? Had she not been invited to the annual dinner of the Aphroditeum Club? Had she not already appeared in the Philitone News, visibly, audibly, and tactually appeared to countless millions all over the planet? Hardly less flattering had been the attentions paid her by conspicuous individuals. The resident world controller's second secretary had asked her to dinner and breakfast. She had spent one weekend with the Ford Chief Justice, and another with the arch-community songster of Canterbury. The president of the Internal and External Secretions Corporation was perpetually on the phone, and she had been to Deauville with the deputy governor of the Bank of Europe. It was wonderful, of course, and yet in a way, she had confessed to Fanny, I feel as though I were getting something on false pretenses. But, of course, the first thing they all want to know is what it's like to make love to a savage. And I have to say, I don't know. She shook her head. Most of the men don't believe me, of course. But it's true. I wish it weren't, she added sadly and sighed. He's terribly good-looking, don't you think so?
But doesn't he like you? Asked Fanny.
"'Sometimes I think he does, and sometimes I think he doesn't. "'He always does his best to avoid me, "'goes out of the room when I come in, won't touch me, won't even look at me. "'But sometimes, if I turn round suddenly, I catch him staring. "'And then, well, you know how men look when they like you.' "'Yes, Fanny knew.
"'I can't make it out,' said Lenina.
"'She couldn't make it out, and not only was bewildered, but also rather upset.'
Because, you see, Fanny, I like him.
Liked him more and more. Well, now there'd be a real chance, she thought, as she scented herself after the bath. Dab, 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 a real chance. Her high spirits overflowed in song.
Hug me till you drug me, honey. Kiss me till I'm in a coma. Hug me, honey, struggly bunny. Love's as good as soma.
The scent organ was playing a delightfully refreshing herbal capriccio, rippling arpeggios of thyme and lavender, of rosemary, basil, myrtle, tarragon, a series of daring modulations through the spice keys into ambergris, and a slow return through sandalwood, camphor, cedar, and new-mown hay, with occasional subtle touches of discord, a whiff of kidney pudding, the faintest suspicion of pig's dung, back to the simple aromatics with which the piece began. The final blast of time died away. There was a round of applause. The lights went up. In the synthetic music machine, the soundtrack roll began to unwind. It was a trio for hyperviolin, supercello, and oboe surrogate that now filled the air with its agreeable languor. 30 or 40 bars, and then, against this instrumental background, a much more than human voice began to warble, now throaty, now from the head, now hollow as a flute, now charged with yearning harmonics. It effortlessly passed from Gaspard Forster's slow record on the very frontiers of musical tone to a trilled bat note high above the highest C to which, in 1770, at the Ducal Opera of Parma, and to the astonishment of Mozart, Lucrezia Adjugari, alone of all the singers in history, once piercingly gave utterance. Sunk in their pneumatic stalls, Lenina and the savage sniffed and listened. It was now the turn also for eyes and skin. The house lights went down. Fiery letters stood out solid, as though self-supported in the darkness.
3 weeks in a helicopter, an all-super-singing, synthetic-talking, coloured, stereoscopic feely, with synchronized scent organ accompaniment.
"Take hold of those metal knobs on the arms of your chair," whispered Lenina. "Otherwise you won't get any of the feely effect." The savage did as he was told.
Those fiery letters, meanwhile, had disappeared. There were 10 seconds of complete darkness. Then suddenly, dazzling and incomparably more solid-looking than they would have been in actual flesh and blood, far more real than reality, there stood the stereoscopic images, locked in one another's arms, of a gigantic negro and a golden-haired young brachycephalic beta-plus female.
The savage started. That sensation on his lips. He lifted a hand to his mouth. The titillation ceased. Let his hand fall back on the metal knob. It began again. The scent organ, meanwhile, breathed pure musk. Expiringly, a soundtrack superdove cooed, "Ooh, ooh," and vibrating only 32 times a second, a deeper-than-African bass made answer,
"Aw, ooh, aw, ooh, aw."
The stereoscopic lips came together again, and once more the facial erogenous zones of the 6,000 spectators in the Alhambra tingled with almost intolerable galvanic pleasure.
Ooh.
The plot of the film was extremely simple. A few minutes after the first oohs and ahs, a duet having been sung, and a little love made on that famous bearskin, every hair of which the assistant predestinator was perfectly right, could be separately and distinctly felt, the negro had a helicopter accident, fell on his head, thump! What a twinge through the forehead. A chorus of "ows" and "ayes" went up from the audience. The concussion knocked all the negro's conditioning into a cocked hat. He developed for the beta blonde an exclusive and maniacal passion. She protested, he persisted. There were struggles, pursuits, an assault on arrival, finally a sensational kidnapping. The beta blonde was ravished away into the sky and kept there, hovering for 3 weeks in a wildly antisocial tête-à-tête with the black madman. Finally, after a whole series of adventures and much aerial acrobacy, 3 handsome young alphas succeeded in rescuing her. The negro was packed off to an adult reconditioning center, and the film ended happily and decorously, with the beta blonde becoming the mistress of all her 3 rescuers. They interrupted themselves for a moment to sing a synthetic quartet with full super-orchestral accompaniment and gardenias on the scent organ. Then the bearskin made a final appearance, and amid a blare of saxophones, the last stereoscopic kiss faded into darkness. The last electric titillation died on the lips like a dying moth that quivers, quivers, ever more feebly, ever more faintly, and at last is quite, quite still. But for Lenina, the moth did not completely die. Even after the lights had gone up, while they were shuffling slowly along with the crowd towards the lifts, its ghost still fluttered against her lips, still traced fine, shuddering roads of anxiety and pleasure across her skin. Her cheeks were flushed, her eyes dewily bright, her breath came deeply. She caught hold of the savage's arm and pressed it, limp, against her side. He looked down at her for a moment, pale, pained, desiring, and ashamed of his desire. He was not worthy, not... Their eyes, for a moment, met. What treasures hers promised! A queen's ransom of temperament! Hastily he looked away, disengaged his imprisoned arm. He was obscurely terrified, lest she should cease to be something he could feel himself unworthy of.
"I don't think you ought to see things like that," he said,
making haste to transfer from Lenina herself to the surrounding circumstances the blame for any past or possible future lapse from perfection.
"Things like what, John?"
"Like this horrible film."
"Horrible?"
Lenina was genuinely astonished.
"But I thought it was lovely."
"It was base," he said indignantly. "It was ignoble."
She shook her head.
"I don't know what you mean."
Why was he so queer?
Why did he go out of his way to spoil things?
In the taxicopter, he hardly even looked at her. Bound by strong vows that had never been pronounced, obedient to laws that had long since ceased to run, he sat averted and in silence. Sometimes, as though a finger had plucked at some taut, almost breaking string, his whole body would shake with a sudden nervous start. The taxicopter landed on the roof of Lenina's apartment house.
"At last," she thought exultantly, as she stepped out of the cab. "At last, even though he had been so queer just now."
Standing under a lamp, she peered into her hand mirror.
"At last."
Yes, her nose was a bit shiny. She shook the loose powder from her puff. While he was paying off the taxi, there would be just time. She rubbed at the shininess, thinking, "He's terribly good-looking. No need for him to be shy like Bernard. And yet any other man would have done it long ago." Well, now at last. That fragment of a face in the little round mirror suddenly smiled at her.
"Good night,"
said a strangled voice behind her. Lenina wheeled round. He was standing in the doorway of the cab, his eyes fixed, staring. Had evidently been staring all this time while she was powdering her nose, waiting, but what for? Or hesitating, trying to make up his mind, and all the time thinking, thinking. She could not imagine what extraordinary thoughts.
"Good night, Lenina," he repeated,
and made a strange, grimacing attempt to smile.
"But, John, I thought you were... I mean, aren't you?"
He shut the door and bent forward to say something to the driver. The cab shot up into the air. Looking down through the window in the floor, the savage could see Lenina's upturned face, pale in the bluish light of the lamps. The mouth was open. She was calling. Her foreshortened figure rushed away from him. The diminishing square of the roof seemed to be falling through the darkness. 5 minutes later, he was back in his room. From its hiding place, he took out his mouse-nibbled volume, turned with religious care its stained and crumpled pages, and began to read Othello. Othello, he remembered, was like the hero of 3 weeks in a helicopter, a black man. Drying her eyes, Lenina walked across the roof to the lift. On her way down to the 27th floor, she pulled out her Soma bottle. 1 gram, she decided, would not be enough. Hers had been more than a 1 gram affliction. But if she took 2 grams, she ran the risk of not waking up in time tomorrow morning. She compromised, and, into her cupped left palm, shook out 3 half-gram tablets. Chapter 12. Bernard had to shout through the locked door. The savage would not open.
"But everybody's there, waiting for you."
"Let them wait,"
came back the muffled voice,
through the door.
"But you know quite well, John."
How difficult it was to sound persuasive at the top of one's voice.
"I asked them on purpose to meet you."
"You ought to have asked me first whether I wanted to meet them."
"But you always came before, John."
"That's precisely why I don't want to come again."
"Just to please me?"
Bernard bellowingly wheedled.
"Won't you come to please me?"
"No."
"Do you seriously mean it?"
"Yes."
Despairingly.
"But what shall I do?"
Bernard wailed.
"Go to hell!"
bawled the exasperated voice from within.
"But the arch-community songster of Canterbury is there tonight."
Bernard was almost in tears.
"Oya takwa!"
It was only in Zuni that the savage could adequately express what he felt about the arch-community songster.
"Hani!"
he added as an afterthought, and then, with what derisive ferocity,
"Sonzi sotsina!"
And he spat on the ground as Pope might have done. In the end, Bernard had to slink back, diminished, to his rooms, and inform the impatient assembly that the savage would not be appearing that evening. The news was received with indignation. The men were furious at having been tricked into behaving politely with this insignificant fellow with the unsavory reputation and the heretical opinions. The higher their position in the hierarchy, the deeper their resentment.
"To play such a joke on me," the arch-songster kept repeating, "on me."
As for the women, they indignantly felt that they had been had on false pretenses, had by a wretched little man who had had alcohol poured into his bottle by mistake, by a creature with a gamma-minus physique. It was an outrage, and they said so more and more loudly. The headmistress of Eton was particularly scathing. Lenina alone said nothing. Pale, her blue eyes clouded with an unwonted melancholy, she sat in a corner, cut off from those who surrounded her by an emotion which they did not share. She had come to the party filled with a strange feeling of anxious exultation. "In a few minutes," she had said to herself as she entered the room, "I shall be seeing him, talking to him, telling him," for she had come with her mind made up, "that I like him more than anybody I've ever known. And then perhaps he'll say..." What would he say? The blood had rushed to her cheeks. Why was he so strange the other night, after the feelies? So queer. And yet I'm absolutely sure he really does rather like me. I'm sure. It was at this moment that Bernard had made his announcement. The savage wasn't coming to the party. Lenina suddenly felt all the sensations normally experienced at the beginning of a violent passion surrogate treatment, a sense of dreadful emptiness, a breathless apprehension, a nausea. Her heart seemed to stop beating. "Perhaps it's because he doesn't like me," she said to herself, and at once this possibility became an established certainty. John had refused to come because he didn't like her. He didn't like her. "It really is a bit too thick," the headmistress of Eton was saying to the director of crematoria and phosphorus reclamation. "When I think that I actually..."
"Yes,"
came the voice of Fanny Crown.
"It's absolutely true about the alcohol. Someone I know knew someone who was working at the embryo store at the time. She said to my friend, and my friend said to me..."
"Too bad, too bad," said Henry Foster, sympathizing with the arch-community songster. "It may interest you to know that our ex-director was on the point of transferring him to Iceland." Pierced by every word that was spoken, the tight balloon of Bernard's happy self-confidence was leaking from a thousand wounds. Pale, distraught, abject and agitated, he moved among his guests, stammering incoherent apologies, assuring them that next time the savage would certainly be there, begging them to sit down and take a carotene sandwich, a slice of vitamin A pâté, a glass of champagne surrogate. They duly ate, but ignored him,
drank, and were either rude to his face or talked to one another about him, loudly and offensively, as though he had not been there.
"And now, my friends,"
said the arch-community songster of Canterbury in that beautiful ringing voice with which he led the proceedings at Ford's Day celebrations,
"now, my friends, I think perhaps the time has come."
He rose, put down his glass, brushed from his purple viscous waistcoat the crumbs of a considerable collation, and walked towards the door. Bernard darted forward to intercept him.
"Must you really, Arch-Songster? It's very early still. I'd hoped you would—"
Yes. What hadn't he hoped, when Lenniner confidentially told him that the arch-community songster would accept an invitation if it were sent?
"He's really rather sweet, you know."
And she had shown Bernard the little golden zipper fastening in the form of a tea, which the arch-songster had given her as a memento of the weekend she had spent at Lambeth.
"To meet the arch-community songster of Canterbury and Mr. Savage."
Bernard had proclaimed his triumph on every invitation card. But the Savage had chosen this evening, of all evenings, to lock himself up in his room, to shout,
"Honey!"
And even, it was lucky that Bernard didn't understand Zuni,
"Sunt isotzina!"
What should have been the crowning moment of Bernard's whole career had turned out to be the moment of his greatest humiliation.
"I'd so much hoped,"
he stammeringly repeated, looking up at the great dignitary with pleading and distracted eyes.
"My young friend,"
said the arch-community songster, in a tone of loud and solemn severity. There was a general silence.
"Let me give you a word of advice."
He wagged his finger at Bernard.
"Before it's too late. A word of good advice."
His voice became sepulchral.
"Mend your ways, my young friend, mend your ways."
He made the sign of the tea over him and turned away.
"Lenniner, my dear," he called in another tone, "come with me."
Obediently, but unsmiling and wholly insensible of the honour done to her, without elation, Lenniner walked after him out of the room. The other guests followed at a respectful interval. The last of them slammed the door. Bernard was all alone. Punctured, utterly deflated, he dropped into a chair and, covering his face with his hands, began to weep. A few minutes later, however, he thought better of it and took 4 tablets of soma. Upstairs in his room, the Savage was reading Romeo and Juliet. Lenniner and the arch-community songster stepped out onto the roof of Lambeth Palace.
"Hurry up, my young friend. I mean, Lenniner,"
called the arch-songster impatiently from the lift gates. Lenniner, who had lingered for a moment to look at the moon, dropped her eyes and came hurrying across the roof to rejoin him. "A New Theory of Biology" was the title of the paper which Mustafa Mond had just finished reading. He sat for some time, meditatively frowning, then picked up his pen and wrote across the title page, "The author's mathematical treatment of the conception of purpose is novel and highly ingenious, but heretical, and, so far as the present social order is concerned, dangerous and potentially subversive. Not to be published." He underlined the words. "The author will be kept under supervision. His transference to the Marine Biological Station of St. Helena may become necessary." A pity, he thought, as he signed his name. It was a masterly piece of work. But once you begin admitting explanations in terms of purpose, well, you didn't know what the result might be. It was the sort of idea that might easily decondition the more unsettled minds among the higher castes, make them lose their faith in happiness as the sovereign good, and take to believing instead that the goal was somewhere beyond, somewhere outside the present human sphere, that the purpose of life was not the maintenance of well-being, but some intensification and refining of consciousness, some enlargement of knowledge. Which was, the controller reflected, quite possibly true, but not, in the present circumstances, admissible. He picked up his pen again, and under the words, "not to be published," drew a second line, thicker and blacker than the first, then sighed. Oh, what fun it would be, he thought, if one didn't have to think about happiness. With closed eyes, his face shining with rapture, John was softly declaiming to vacancy,
"Oh, she doth teach the torches to burn bright. It seems she hangs upon the cheek of night, like a rich jewel in an Ethiop's ear. Beauty too rich for use, for earth too dear."
The golden tea lay shining on Lenina's bosom. Sportively, the arch-community songster caught hold of it. Sportively, he pulled, pulled.
"I think," said Lenina suddenly, breaking a long silence, "I better take a couple of grams of soma."
Bernard, by this time, was fast asleep and smiling at the private paradise of his dreams. Smiling, smiling. But inexorably, every 30 seconds, the minute hand of the electric clock above his bed jumped forward with an almost imperceptible click, 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 click. And it was morning. Bernard was back among the miseries of space and time. It was in the lowest spirits that he taxied across to his work at the conditioning center. The intoxication of success had evaporated. He was soberly his old self, and by contrast with the temporary balloon of these last weeks, the old self seemed unprecedentedly heavier than the surrounding atmosphere. To this deflated Bernard, the savage showed himself unexpectedly sympathetic.
"You're more like what you were at Malpais," he said when Bernard had told him his plaintive story. "Do you remember when we first talked together, outside the little house? You're like what you were then."
"Because I'm unhappy again, that's why."
"Well, I'd rather be unhappy than have the sort of false, lying happiness you were having here."
"I like that," said Bernard bitterly, "when it's you who were the cause of it all, refusing to come to my party, and so turning them all against me."
He knew that what he was saying was absurd in its injustice. He admitted inwardly, and at last even aloud, the truth of all that the savage now said about the worthlessness of friends who could be turned, upon so slight a provocation, into persecuting enemies. But in spite of this knowledge and these admissions, in spite of the fact that his friend's support and sympathy were now his only comfort, Bernard continued perversely to nourish, along with his quite genuine affection, a secret grievance against the savage, to meditate a campaign of small revenges to be wreaked upon him. Nourishing a grievance against the arch-community songster was useless. There was no possibility of being revenged on the chief butler or the assistant predestinator. As a victim, the savage possessed, for Bernard, this enormous superiority over the others, that he was accessible. One of the principal functions of a friend is to suffer, in a milder and symbolic form, the punishment that we should like, but are unable, to inflict upon our enemies. Bernard's other victim friend was Helmholtz. When discomfited, he came and asked once more for the friendship which, in his prosperity, he had not thought it worth his while to preserve. Helmholtz gave it, and gave it without a reproach, without a comment, as though he had forgotten that there had ever been a quarrel. Touched, Bernard felt himself at the same time humiliated by this magnanimity, a magnanimity the more extraordinary and therefore the more humiliating in that it owed nothing to Soma, and everything to Helmholtz's character. It was the Helmholtz of daily life who forgot and forgave, not the Helmholtz of a half-gram holiday. Bernard was duly grateful. It was an enormous comfort to have his friend again, and also duly resentful. It will be a pleasure to take some revenge on Helmholtz for his generosity. At their first meeting after the estrangement, Bernard poured out the tale of his miseries and accepted consolation. It was not until some days later that he learned, to his surprise and with a twinge of shame, that he was not the only one who had been in trouble. Helmholtz had also come into conflict with authority. "It was over some rhymes," he explained. "I was giving my usual course of advanced emotional engineering for third-year students. 12 lectures, of which the 7th is about rhymes. On the use of rhymes in moral propaganda and advertisement, to be precise. I always illustrate my lecture with a lot of technical examples. This time, I thought I'd give them one I'd just written myself. Pure madness, of course, but I couldn't resist it." He laughed. "I was curious to see what their reaction would be. Besides," he added more gravely, "I wanted to do a bit of propaganda. I was trying to engineer them into feeling as I'd felt when I wrote the rhymes." "Thought!" He laughed again. "What an outcry there was! The principal had me up and threatened to hand me the immediate sack. I'm a marked man."
"But what were your rhymes?" Bernard asked.
"They were about being alone." Bernard's eyebrows went up. "I'll recite them to you if you like." And Helmholtz began. "Yesterday's committee, sticks but a broken drum. Midnight in the city, flutes in a vacuum, shut lips, sleeping faces, every stopped machine, the dumb and littered places where crowds have been. All silences rejoice, weep, loudly or low, speak, but with the voice of whom I do not know. Absence, say, of Susan's, absence of Egeria's, arms and respective bosoms, lips and, posteriors, slowly form a presence. Whose, and I ask, of what so absurd an essence that something which is not nevertheless should populate empty night more solidly than that with which we copulate? Why should it seem so squalidly?" "Well, I gave them that as an example, and they reported me to the principal."
"I'm not surprised," said Bernard. "It's flatly against all their sleep teaching. Remember, they've had at least 250,000 warnings against solitude."
"I know, but I thought I'd like to see what the effect would be. Well, you've seen now." Helmholtz only laughed. "I feel," he said after a silence, "as though I were just beginning to have something to write about. As though I were beginning to be able to use that power I feel I've got inside me, that extra latent power. Something seems to be coming to me." In spite of all his troubles, he seemed, Bernard thought, profoundly happy. Helmholtz and the savage took to one another at once. So cordially indeed that Bernard felt a sharp pang of jealousy. In all these weeks, he had never come to so close an intimacy with the savage as Helmholtz immediately achieved. Watching them, listening to their talk, he found himself sometimes resentfully wishing that he had never brought them together. He was ashamed of his jealousy, and alternately made efforts of will and took soma to keep himself from feeling it. But the efforts were not very successful, and between the soma holidays there were, of necessity, intervals. The odious sentiment kept on returning. At his third meeting with the savage, Helmholtz recited his rhymes on solitude. "What do you think of them?" he asked when he had done. The savage shook his head.
"Listen to this,"
was his answer. And unlocking the drawer in which he kept his mouse-eaten book, he opened and read,
"Let the bird of loudest lay on the sole Arabian tree, herald sad and trumpet be."
Helmholtz listened with a growing excitement. At Sole Arabian Tree he started. At Thou Shrieking Harbinger he smiled with sudden pleasure. At Every Fowl of Tyrant Wing the blood rushed up into his cheeks. But at Defunctive Music he turned pale and trembled with an unprecedented emotion. The savage read on. Property was thus appalled, that the self was not the same. Single nature's double name, neither two nor one was called. Reason in itself confounded, saw division grow together.
Orgy, porgy, ha 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 ha,
said Bernard, interrupting the reading with a loud, unpleasant laugh.
Is't if the solidarity service him?
He was revenging himself on his two friends for liking one another more than they liked him. In the course of their next two or three meetings, he frequently repeated this little act of vengeance. It was simple, and since both Helmholtz and the savage were dreadfully pained by the shattering and defilement of a favorite poetic crystal, extremely effective. In the end, Helmholtz threatened to kick him out of the room if he dared to interrupt again. And yet, strangely enough, the next interruption, the most disgraceful of all, came from Helmholtz himself. The savage was reading Romeo and Juliet aloud, reading, for all the time he was seeing himself as Romeo and Leonina as Juliet, with an intense and quivering passion. Helmholtz had listened to the scene of the lovers' first meeting with a puzzled interest. The scene in the orchard had delighted him with its poetry, but the sentiments expressed had made him smile. Getting into such a state about having a girl, it seemed rather ridiculous. But taken detail by verbal detail, what a superb piece of emotional engineering. "That old fellow," he said, "he makes our best propaganda technicians look absolutely silly." The savage smiled triumphantly and resumed his reading. All went tolerably well until, in the last scene of the third act, Capulet and Lady Capulet began to bully Juliet to marry Paris. Helmholtz had been restless throughout the entire scene, but when, pathetically mimed by the savage, Juliet cried out,
"Is there no pity sitting in the clouds that sees into the bottom of my grief? Oh, sweet my mother, cast me not away. Delay this marriage for a month, a week, or if you do not, make the bridal bed in that dim monument where Tybalt lies."
When Juliet said this, Helmholtz broke out in an explosion of uncontrollable guffawing. The mother and father, grotesque obscenity, forcing the daughter to have someone she didn't want, and the idiotic girl not saying that she was having someone else whom, for the moment at any rate, she preferred. In its smutty absurdity, the situation was irresistibly comical. He had managed, with a heroic effort, to hold down the mounting pressure of his hilarity, but,
"Sweet mother!"
in the savage's tremulous tone of anguish, and the reference to Tybalt lying dead but evidently uncremated and wasting his phosphorus on a dim monument were too much for him. He laughed and laughed till the tears streamed down his face, quenchlessly laughed while, pale with a sense of outrage, the savage looked at him over the top of his book, and then, as the laughter still continued, closed it indignantly, got up, and with a gesture of one who removes his pearl from before the swine, locked it away in its drawer.
"And yet," said Helmholtz, having recovered breath enough to apologize, he had mollified the savage into listening to his explanations. "I know quite well that one needs ridiculous, mad situations like that. One can't write really well about anything else. Why was that fellow such a marvelous propaganda technician? Because he had so many insane, excruciating things to get excited about. You've got to be hurt and upset, otherwise you can't think of the really good, penetrating, X-ray-ish phrases. But fathers and mothers..." He shook his head. "You can't expect me to keep a straight face about fathers and mothers. And who's going to get excited about a boy having a girl or not having her?"
The savage winced, but Helmholtz, who was staring pensively at the floor, saw nothing. No, he concluded with a sigh, it won't do. We need some other kind of madness and violence. But what? What? Where can one find it? He was silent, then, shaking his head, I don't know, he said at last. I don't know. Chapter 13 Henry Foster loomed up through the twilight of the embryo store. Like to come to Ophelia this evening? Lenina shook her head without speaking. Going out with someone else? It interested him to know which of his friends was being had by which other. Is it Benito? He questioned. She shook her head again. Henry detected the weariness in those purple eyes, the pallor beneath that glaze of lupus, the sadness at the corners of the unsmiling crimson mouth. You're not feeling ill, are you? He asked, a trifle anxiously, afraid that she might be suffering from one of the few remaining infectious diseases. Yet once more, Lenina shook her head. Anyhow, you ought to go and see the doctor, said Henry. A doctor a day keeps the jim-jams away, he added heartily, driving home his hypnopedic adage with a clap on the shoulder. Perhaps you need a pregnancy substitute, he suggested, or else an extra-strong VPS treatment. Sometimes, you know, the standard passion surrogate isn't quite... Oh, for Ford's sake, said Lenina, breaking her stubborn silence, shut up! And she turned back to her neglected embryos. A VPS treatment, indeed. She would have laughed if she hadn't been on the point of crying. As though she hadn't got enough VP of her own. She sighed profoundly as she refilled her syringe.
John, she murmured to herself. John.
Then, oh, my Ford, she wondered. Have I given this one its sleeping sickness injection, or haven't I? She simply couldn't remember. In the end, she decided not to run the risk of letting it have a second dose, and moved down the line to the next bottle. 22 years, 8 months, and 4 days from that moment, a promising young Alpha Minus administrator at Mwanza Mwanza was to die of trypanosomiasis, the first case for over half a century. Sighing, Lenina went on with her work. An hour later, in the changing room, Fanny was energetically protesting.
But it's absurd to let yourself get into a state like this. Simply absurd, she repeated. And what about a man, one man?
But he's the one I want.
As though there weren't millions of other men in the world. But I don't want them. But how can you know till you've tried?
I have tried.
But how many? Asked Fanny, shrugging her shoulders contemptuously. One? Two?
Dozens, but, shaking her head,
it wasn't any good, she added. Well, you must persevere, said Fanny sententiously.
But it was obvious that her confidence in her own prescriptions had been shaken. Nothing can be achieved without perseverance.
But meanwhile, don't think of him. I can't help it. Take Soma, then.
I do.
Well, go on. But in the intervals, I still like him. I shall always like him.
Well, if that's the case, said Fanny with decision, why didn't you just go and take him, whether he wants it or no?
But if you knew how terribly queer he was. All the more reason for taking a firm line.
Oh, it's all very well to say that.
Don't stand any nonsense. Act.
Fanny's voice was a trumpet. She might have been a YWFA lecturer, giving an evening talk to adolescent beta minuses.
Yes, act, at once. Do it now.
I'd be scared, said Lenina.
Well, you've only got to take half a gram of Soma first, and now I'm going to have my bath.
She marched off, trailing her towel. The bell rang, and the savage, who was impatiently hoping that Helmholtz would come that afternoon, for having at last made up his mind to talk to Helmholtz about Lenina, he could not bear to postpone his confidences a moment longer, jumped up and ran to the door.
"I had a premonition it was you, Helmholtz," he shouted as he opened.
On the threshold, in a white acetate satin sailor suit and with a round white cap rakishly tilted over her left ear, stood Lenina.
"Oh!"
said the savage, as though someone had struck him a heavy blow. Half a gram had been enough to make Lenina forget her fears and her embarrassments.
"Hello, John," she said, smiling,
and walked past him into the room. Automatically he closed the door and followed her. Lenina sat down. There was a long silence.
"You don't seem very glad to see me, John," she said at last. "Not glad?"
The savage looked at her reproachfully, then suddenly fell on his knees before her, and, taking Lenina's hand, reverently kissed it.
"Not glad! Oh, if only you knew!"
he whispered, and venturing to raise his eyes to her face.
"Admired Lenina," he went on. "Indeed, the top of admiration, worth what's dearest in the world."
She smiled at him with a luscious tenderness.
"Oh, you so perfect!"
She was leaning towards him with parted lips.
"So perfect, so peerless are created." Nearer and nearer. "Of every creature's best."
Still nearer. The savage suddenly scrambled to his feet.
"That's why," he said, speaking with averted face, "I wanted to do something first. I mean, to show you I was worthy of you. Not that I could ever really be that. But at any rate, to show I wasn't absolutely unworthy, I wanted to do something."
"Why should you think it necessary?" Lenina began, but left the sentence unfinished. There was a note of irritation in her voice. When one has leant forward, nearer and nearer, with parted lips, only to find oneself quite suddenly, as a clumsy oaf scrambles to his feet, leaning towards nothing at all, well, there is a reason, even with half a gram of soma circulating in one's bloodstream, a genuine reason for annoyance.
"At my pace," the savage was incoherently mumbling, "you had to bring her the skin of a mountain lion. I mean, when you wanted to marry someone, or else a wolf. There aren't any lions in England,"
Lenina almost snapped.
"And even if there were," the savage added with a sudden contemptuous resentment, "people would kill them out of helicopters, I suppose, with poison gas or something. I wouldn't do that, Lenina."
He squared his shoulders. He ventured to look at her, and was met with a stare of annoyed incomprehension. Confused.
"I'll do anything," he went on, more and more incoherently. "Anything you tell me. There be some sports are painful, you know. But their labour, delight in them, sets off. That's what I feel. I mean, I'd sweep the floor if you wanted."
"But we've got vacuum cleaners here," said Lenina in bewilderment. "It isn't necessary."
"No, of course it isn't necessary. But some kinds of baseness are nobly undergone. I'd like to undergo something nobly, don't you see?"
"But if there are vacuum cleaners..."
"That's not the point!
And Epsilon semi-morons to work them," she went on.
"Well, really, why?" "Why? But for you! For you! Just to show that I..."
"And what on earth vacuum cleaners have got to do with lions?"
"To show how much..."
"Or lions being glad to see me?" She was getting more and more exasperated.
"How much I love you, Lenina!"
he brought out almost desperately. An emblem of the inner tide of startled elation, the blood rushed up into Lenina's cheeks.
"Do you mean it, John?" "But I hadn't meant to say so," cried the savage,
clasping his hands in a kind of agony.
"Not until... Listen, Lenina, in Malpace people get married."
"Get what?" The irritation had begun to creep back into her voice. What was he talking about now?
"For always. They make a promise to live together. For always."
What a horrible idea. Lenina was genuinely shocked.
"Outliving beauties outward with a mind that doth renew swifter than blood decays."
"What?"
"It's like that in Shakespeare, too. If thou dost break her virgin knot before all sanctimonious ceremonies may with full and holy rite..."
"For fault's sake, John, talk sense. I can't understand a word you're saying. First it's vacuum cleaners, then it's knots. You're driving me crazy." She jumped up, and, as though afraid that he might run away from her physically, as well as with his mind, caught him by the wrist. "Answer me this question. Do you really like me, or don't you?" There was a moment's silence. Then, in a very low voice, "I love you more than anything in the world," he said.
"Then why on earth didn't you say so?"
she cried. And so intense was her exasperation that she drove her sharp nails into the skin of his wrist. "Instead of drivelling away about knots and vacuum cleaners and lions, and making me miserable for weeks and weeks." She released his hand and flung it angrily away from her. "If I didn't like you so much," she said, "I'd be furious with you." And suddenly her arms were around his neck. He felt her lips soft against his own, so deliciously soft, so warm and electric that inevitably he found himself thinking of the embraces in 3 weeks in a helicopter. Ooh, ooh, the stereoscopic blonde, and ah, the more than real blackamoor. Horror, horror, horror! He tried to disengage himself, but Lenina tightened her embrace.
"Why didn't you say so?"
she whispered, drawing back her face to look at him. Her eyes were tenderly reproachful. "The murkiest den, the most opportune place," the voice of conscience thundered poetically. "The strongest suggestion or worse a genius can shall never melt mine honour into lust. Never, never," he resolved. "You silly boy," she was saying. "I wanted you so much. And if you wanted me too, why didn't you?" "But Leniner," he began protesting, and as she immediately untwined her arms, as she stepped away from him, he thought for a moment that she had taken his unspoken hint. But when she unbuckled her white patent cartridge belt and hung it carefully over the back of a chair, he began to suspect that he had been mistaken. "Leniner," he repeated apprehensively. She put her hand to her neck and gave a long vertical pull. Her white sailor's blouse was ripped to the hem, suspicion condensed into a too solid certainty. "Leniner, what are you doing?" Zip, zip. Her answer was wordless. She stepped out of her bell-bottom trousers. Her zippy kamenics were a pale shell pink. The arch-community songster's golden tea dangled at her breast. "For those milk paps that through the window bars bore at men's eyes." The singing, thundering, magical words made her seem doubly dangerous, doubly alluring. Soft, soft, but how piercing, boring and drilling into reason, tunnelling through resolution. "The strongest oaths are straw to the fire i' the blood. Be more abstemious or else..." Zip! The rounded pinkness fell apart, like a neatly divided apple. A wriggle of the arms, a lifting first of the right foot, then the left. The zippy kamenics were lying lifeless and as though deflated on the floor. Still wearing her shoes and socks, and her rakishly tilted round white cap, she advanced towards him. "Darling, darling, if only you'd said so before." She held out her arms. But instead of also saying, "Darling," and holding out his arms, the savage retreated in terror, flapping his hands at her, as though he were trying to scare away some intruding and dangerous animal. 4 backward steps, and he was brought to bay against the wall. "Sweet," said Lenina, and laying her hands on his shoulders, pressed herself against him. "Put your arms round me," she commanded. "Hug me till you drug me, honey." She too had poetry at her command, new words that sang and were spells and beat drums. "Kiss me." She closed her eyes. She let her voice sink to a sleepy murmur. "Kiss me till I'm in a coma. Hug me, honey, snugly." The savage caught her by the wrists, tore her hand from his shoulders, thrust her roughly away at arm's length. "Oh, you're hurting me, oh!" She was suddenly silent. Terror had made her forget the pain. Opening her eyes,
She had seen his face. No, not his face. A ferocious stranger's, pale, distorted, twitching with some insane, inexplicable fury. Aghast. "But what is it, John?" she whispered. He did not answer, but only stared into her face with those mad eyes. The hands that held her wrists were trembling. He breathed deeply and irregularly, faint almost to imperceptibility, but appalling. She suddenly heard the grinding of his teeth. "What is it?" she almost screamed. And, as though awakened by her cry, he caught her by the shoulders and shook her. "Whore!" he shouted. "Whore! Impudent strumpet!"
"Oh, don't, don't!"
she protested in a voice made grotesquely tremulous by his shaking.
"Whore! Please! Damned whore! A gram is better!"
she began. The savage pushed her away with such force that she staggered and fell.
"Go!" he shouted, standing over her menacingly. "Get out of my sight or I'll kill you!"
He clenched his fists. Lenina raised her arms, covered her face.
"No, please don't, John. Hurry up, quick!"
One arm still raised, and following his every movement with a terrified eye, she scrambled to her feet, and still crouching, still covering her head, made a dash for the bathroom. The noise of that prodigious slap by which her departure was accelerated was like a pistol shot.
"Oh!"
Lenina bounded forward. Safely locked into the bathroom, she had leisure to take stock of her injuries. Standing with her back to the mirror, she twisted her head. Looking over her left shoulder, she could see the imprint of an open hand standing out distinct and crimson on the pearly flesh. Gingerly, she rubbed the wounded spot. Outside, in the other room, the savage was striding up and down, marching, marching to the drums and music of magical words.
"The wren goes to it, and the small gilded fly does lecture in my sight."
Maddeningly they rumbled in his ears.
"The fichu, nor the soiled horse, goes to it with a more riotous appetite. Down from the waist they are centres, though women all above, but to the girdle do the gods inherit. Beneath is all the fiends. There's hell, there's darkness, there is the sulphurous pit, burning, scalding, stench, consumption, fie, 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 pa, fa. Give me an ounce of civet, good apothecary, to sweeten my imagination."
"John,"
ventured a small, ingratiating voice from the bathroom.
"John."
"Oh, thou weed, who art so lovely fair and smelt so sweet that the sense aches at thee. Was this most goodly book made to write whore upon? Heaven stops the nose at it."
But her perfume still hung about him. His jacket was white with the powder that had scented her velvety body.
"Impudent strumpet! Impudent strumpet! Impudent strumpet!"
The inexorable rhythm beat itself out.
"Impudent!"
"John, do you think I might have my clothes?"
He picked up the bell-bottom trousers, the blouse, the zippy kaminix.
"Open!"
he ordered, kicking the door.
"No, I won't."
The voice was frightened and defiant.
"Well, how do you expect me to give them to you?"
"Push them through the ventilator over the door."
He did what she suggested, and returned to his uneasy pacing of the room.
"Impudent strumpet! Impudent strumpet! The devil luxury with his fat rump and potato finger!
John!"
He would not answer.
"Fat rump and potato finger!
John!"
"What is it?" he asked gruffly.
"I wonder if you mind giving me my Malthusian belt."
Lenina sat listening to the footsteps in the other room, wondering, as she listened, how long he was likely to go tramping up and down like that, whether she would have to wait until he left the flat, or if it would be safe, after allowing his madness a reasonable time to subside, to open the bathroom door and make a dash for it. She was interrupted in the midst of these uneasy speculations by the sound of the telephone bell ringing in the other room. Abruptly, the tramping ceased. She heard the voice of the savage parleying with silence.
"Hello?"
Yes? If I do not usurp myself, I am. Yes, didn't you hear me say so, Mr.